In the 21st century, nationalism has become dangerously familiar. We're not easily shocked anymore, but the ethnic nationalism promoted by the Indian government still stands out. Today we ask, will COVID-19 make it even worse?
The coronavirus is the biggest threat this country has faced for decades.
We're at war. In a true sense, we're at war.
There's an ancient Chinese expression that says, may you live in interesting times.
Welcome to Coronavirus Lockdown with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. There's no question we're living through a moment of profound change, but increasingly that looks like a choice. A new democratic vision, including a democratic way of running our economy, or nationalism, authoritarianism, and racism. One of the most troubling cases of the new nationalism is the regime of Narendra Modi in India. In this podcast, we tell the story of Modi's authoritarianism, drawing out its historical roots.
It is Narendra Modi's hour of triumph.
Staggering is the word. There hasn't been a landslide like this since 1984.
Some have accused him of creating an authoritarian government.
It's a situation of absolute lunacy.
In the digital studio, we're joined by Priyamvada Gopal, reader at the Faculty of English, Cambridge University, and fellow of Churchill College. Her most recent book is Insurgent Empire, Anti-Colonial Resistance and British Descent. Priya is publicly engaged on many subjects, but she has been particularly active in fighting to break the global silence on Modi's India and draw attention to the terrible persecution of the country's Muslim population. To feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future, email podcast@anothereurope.org. You can support the podcast by leaving a rating or review on your podcast platform. An extended version is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. To join and support our work, go to anothereurope.org/join. It's cheap as chips and makes a big difference.
So welcome, Priya, to the show. Welcome back to the show, I should say, because I remember our last brilliant podcast. We haven't covered Indian politics before. So in the spirit of not assuming knowledge before we go on, can we talk about the recent events in Indian politics? First off, could you tell us about Narendra Modi and his party, the BJP?
Right. The BJP is the Bharatiya Janata Party, or the Indian People's Party, and it is the political arm of an organization called the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is a secretive organization that's been around since 1925. So it's approaching its 100th anniversary. And Modi is a lifelong member of the RSS. The RSS was founded in 1925. It was and is a militarized organization. It has a uniform of white shirts and khaki shorts. It was modeled on the colonial police. And in ways that find parallels in Europe in the 1930s, it stressed physical and mental discipline. So bodybuilding and exercise remain very central to its regimen. It was founded on the notion that Hindu men had been weakened or feminized through colonialism, and that they needed to recover a certain lost masculinity. The organization is explicitly hierarchical. Those selected for membership take an oath to remain life members under the oversight of the supreme leader. And their commitment is to a militarized, strong Hindu nation, or a Hindu Rashtra, as they call it. Now, Nehru, Jawaharlal Nehru, the first prime minister of India, referred to the RSS as an Indian version of fascism. Mm-hmm. Right, but that was not a particularly exaggerated understanding. He was alluding in part to the modeling of the RSS on Italian fascist organizations. But you don't have to take Nehru's word for it. RSS founding figures were explicitly admiring of Mussolini, of Nazism. The RSS's second and most influential leader, M.S. Kolwalkar, very explicitly drew on German theorists in the 1930s. He was admiring of ethnically homogenous theories of nation. And let me just give you a quotation from him, which will give you a flavor of the RSS. "To keep up the purity of the race and its culture, Germany shocked the world by her purging of the Semitic races, the Jews. Race pride at its highest has been manifested here." And then he goes on to say that this is a good lesson for us in Hindustan to learn and profit by. And one would wish to think that things have changed in 100 years, but I'm afraid that the RSS's core ideology, which is India as a homogenized, powerful Hindu nation, is very much at the heart of the BJP's own vision of India. And maybe the main difference from its German cousin in the 1930s is that Hindutva, which is the ideology of the Hindu nation, tends to speak of cultural and religious homogeneity rather than racial purity. So how do we understand Narendra Modi? We understand Narendra Modi as very much a direct offshoot and the most successful public figure produced by the RSS through the political arm of the BJP.
So when he won his first landslide, which was 2014, that must have been quite chilling. Did people take it pretty seriously?
I should say that I wouldn't describe the first victory as a landslide. It was a decisive victory. It was over a third of the total votes cast. It was the single leading party. It was completely leading. Not least because until then, been a sense that the case of Modi in Gujarat, where there were, as you will recall, terrible pogroms in 2002, that Modi was a state phenomenon, and that although he belonged to the BJP and the RSS, that the rabidity of the discourse of Hindutva as he represented it was containable in the state of Gujarat. And I think that it came as a terrible shock to people who were, in one sense or the other, committed to an ideal pluralist and secularist, to actually see that an ideology of ethno-nationalism and rabid Islamophobia actually had a national presence and could succeed at the ballot box. And it absolutely came as a real shock in 2014.
And how do you account then for his repeated victory in 2019? Was that a failure of the opposition, or has he proven popular in unexpected ways, or is there a combination of both?
It's a combination of the two. To dispense with the question of the opposition, there is no doubt that India is suffering from a crisis of opposition. The Congress Party is considered widely and not incorrectly dynastic and corrupt. It has not been able to pull away from the stranglehold of the Nehru-Gandhi family. And this is something that the BJP has been able to use to good effect to point out the corruption, to point out that the party is in the hands of a single family, that they're unable to let, you know, leaders rise from the ranks. And there is great mistrust, not always well-founded, but often justified, of the Nehru-Gandhi family. And this has been to the great strength of the BJP. So there is no single party serious opposition to the BJP right now. So the more worrying phenomenon is the extent to which hatred and ethno-nationalism and majoritarianism have spread in Indian civil society. When I go home now, the average conversation at a dining table or with friends and extended family is steeped with the rhetoric of minority bashing, of needing to put minorities in their place, specifically of Muslims as problematic, as insufficiently loyal to India. What the BJP has been able to do very successfully is infiltrate and popularize majoritarian ideologies in civil society. And here the Indian media is absolutely culpable. I do not exaggerate, I think, when I say that the Indian media is Fox News in the US on steroids. Multiple channels spouting bigotry, hatred, selective stories, outright falsehoods, unchallenged claims about minority communities. And basically, Indians are on a drip feed of majoritarian poison every single day. And they pretty much have no access or choose to not have access to anything that is remotely balanced or objective or historically correct. And so we have a civil society that is in the BJP's pocket.
This has coincided with a period of some prosperity. So it seems like a strange time for all the kind of progressive breaks on that to completely give way.
Yes, I mean, one of the success stories as far as the BJP and the RSS in India are concerned is that they have been able to rehabilitate and mainstream themselves. And in part because of their yoking their cart, their horse to neoliberalism. And this is a strange yoking because, let us say, even 20 years ago, parts of the RSS were, and even now, minor parts of it remain very hostile to globalization and to capitalism. But people like Modi, who have success stories, have thrown their weight behind globalization, neoliberalism, global capitalism. And it is really no accident that Hindutva has risen alongside the entrance of India into the, you know, the global big league of the BRIC economies, the emergent economies. And of course, when the war on terror continues to be a kind of global keynote. And this has been their immense success, yoking Indian nationalism to India as one of the big economic players in the world. And it coincides with the huge gap between the top 1% of earners in India and the bottom 10% who remain incredibly poor, and the country remains incredibly poor.
I was watching, I think 7 years ago or so, a remarkable documentary called The World Before Her, a Canadian documentary, and I came to it from a position of terrible ignorance, to be honest, about India, but I thought it was quite an incredible piece of work. I don't know if you've seen it, but it follows two young women. One is a member of a Hindu nationalist movement, the VHP, and the language that is used throughout the film towards Muslims is really quite extraordinary.
We are going to face them. In that, if it is needed, we have to kill. We won't see here and there. We are going to kill them.
Extraordinarily laden with violence. And I get the impression from what you've been saying so far, Priya, that you feel that that kind of language, I mean, I think the VHP in itself has millions of members, but this is not unusual in such a vast country. But I get the impression from what you're saying that this language and discourse has seeped much, much wider beyond the fringe and into the mainstream of Indian society.
It's completely normalized. So if I could make a comparison, in Britain, we are shocked when people like Katie Hopkins talk about migrants as cockroaches or parasites. And of course, you know, there is a problem with this kind of language in Britain, in America, in Europe, but it still remains confined to the fringe. But the language of talking about Muslims as a problem, minorities as a problem, minorities as, you know, waging, for instance, love jihad, or, you know, Muslim men romancing Hindu women deliberately in order to take them away from their communities. More recently, there has been the language of Corona jihad, where Muslims, with the assistance of the media and people in government, have been targeted as the cause of coronavirus in India. So talking about Corona jihad is a way of talking about Muslims in India as waging jihad through the coronavirus. So the language of Muslims as an infection, as a problem in the body politic, as bringing in alien elements, as parasites, as waging war, this is all very, very normal. And it is not confined to fringe elements. It's part of the terrifying world of Indian WhatsApp, which routinely peddles fake news on a scale that I think is still not entirely imaginable in the West. And yeah, this kind of language, which was once confined to the fringe, is very mainstream in India today. And targeting Muslims, targeting Muslim groups, is routine, and it is routine in the Indian media as much as anywhere else.
And so we've covered, I guess, the regressive impacts that this violent political discourse has on the Indian polity. Could we also talk maybe more now about specifically the policies that Modi has carried through towards the Indian Muslim population? The most notable one that shot into international prominence is the citizenship law. So I was wondering if you could tell us about that. What is it? What does it do? What does it mean for Indian democracy?
Yeah, so the citizenship Amendment Act, which was passed in December 2019 and was being protested until quite recently, until the lockdown recently, is a version, if you combine it with another plan, the National Register of Indian Citizens, the NRC, combining these two projects, it has rightly been referred to as the Indian version of Germany's 1935 Nuremberg laws, by which German citizens were only those people who had been granted citizenship papers or legacy papers by the Third Reich. The Citizenship Amendment Bill, without much hyperbole, is comparable to that. Now, on the face of it, all it's saying is that India will offer asylum and refuge to persecuted minorities from nearby countries. It doesn't actually use the word persecuted, but that is the implication. However, the act applies to all religions, essentially, but Muslims. So the main point of the Citizenship Act does not seem to be humanitarian, but it seems to be aimed at excluding a particular religion. And in fact, it makes absolutely no sense, because if you really cared about persecuted groups from neighboring countries, you would be focusing on the Rohingyas from Myanmar. You would be looking at Ahmadis and Hazaras from, you know, Afghanistan and Pakistan. But if you're excluding Muslims, then you're actually excluding a very large number of persecuted religious groups in neighboring countries. People worry rightly that when this is combined with the National Register of Citizens, which has already brought great grief in the Indian state of Assam, where the exercise was carried out, people worry that this is really aimed eventually at disenfranchising Indian Muslims. Mm-hmm. And although, of course, this has been met by all kinds of denials and insistence by the government that the National Register of Citizens is completely separate from the Citizenship Amendment Act, which in turn is completely separate from the National Population Register, the worry is that these are all enfranchisement, disenfranchisement exercises, mm-hmm. which are targeted at disenfranchising one particular community, and also essentially underscoring that the only people who have an unambiguous right to be Indian citizens are people who can establish that they are Hindus. So I guess the easiest point of comparison, therefore, is the Nuremberg laws, that this is a state which is saying that there are only certain people who have the right to citizenship, and those are the majority community, the Hindu community.
And am I right in thinking that one of the reasons that this is so pernicious is that the question of whether someone has citizenship is not always clear in countries where you have very large exploited migrant populations? Is that right?
That is absolutely right. And that is exactly what happened in Assam. You know, India's border states do have very large migrant populations. But the other thing to say is that these are not record-keeping cultures. Although colonialism brought in paper records, a great number of people, and I would say, you know, if you asked my grandparents for papers, they wouldn't be able to produce any. So there are vast swathes of people, many of whom are extremely poor, who have no records. So the question is, how then do you start to decide what the correct papers are, and who gets to show that they are citizens of India, and who gets to automatically be considered not a citizen until they can prove that they are a citizen? So it is complete nightmare territory, and Indian Muslims are rightly terrified that they are in its sights.
And could I also ask a question around the relationship between Modi to the rest of the world? Because I follow you on Twitter, I feel that I have a much more informed understanding of what's happening in India, even as someone who's not particularly informed, to the great, great majority of people, because Modi has visited Britain. I mean, he's considered a normal international statesperson of a rising power, and he is not ostracized as far as I can see at all. So there's that aspect. And then I was also curious, like, how much the kind of Islamophobia of the 9/11 West has been important to Hindu nationalists. Have they taken it up and incorporated it into their arguments?
Here's the thing. Narendra Modi was banned from traveling to the United Kingdom and to the United States. I can't remember specifically about Europe, but certainly he was denied a visa to travel to the United Kingdom until really he shot to national power. And both countries revoked their visa bans, ostensibly because there had been some kind of judicial clean chit. Now, without going into the details of that so-called clean chit, what is interesting is how do you ban someone from traveling to your country precisely because there are very difficult and troubling questions to be asked about what happened in Gujarat in 2002, and then decide overnight to revoke those bans. So yes, he's not ostracized. In fact, he very recently held an extremely successful rally in Texas alongside Donald Trump, where they essentially did a victory lap together. Now, part of this is explainable by the fact that India is a rising economic power, and India, if you want trade, if your eye is on the money, then you cannot turn your face away either from India or from Brazil or from China. But it is also, I think, going hand in hand with the rise of right-wing authoritarian figures in the West. I mean, Trump is a natural ally for Modi. Bolsonaro in Brazil was the chief guest this year at India's very prestigious Republic Day parade. They are natural allies for someone like Modi. They have a similar ethno-nationalist values. They trade in bigotry. They trade in capitalism as the bottom line. So yes, to some extent, Modi's rehabilitation has to do with both economics and the rise of authoritarianism in the West. On the question of Islamophobia, it has absolutely been helpful to have Islamophobia in the West and the war on terror, so-called, for India to claim that it too is participating in the war on terror and that therefore the use of draconian anti-terror legislation against people, against journalists, against dissidents is part of that worldwide fight. But I also should say that Islamophobia in the West, rising as it is and troubling as it is trailing behind the levels of Islamophobia that we would see in India today. So yes, India gets a free pass on targeting its Muslim communities because of Islamophobia in the West. But Islamophobia in the West is still of a lesser order to what we would see in India today.
Let's talk about the relationship between Islamophobia and the geopolitics still, but this time in relation to Kashmir and Pakistan, because there's two things that Modi has been embroiled in here, I think. Like, one is the abolition of the special status for the Kashmiri province within the Indian state. And then the other, we had the terrifying confrontation last February between India and Pakistan. Two nuclear armed powers had this intensely dangerous standoff over the disputed province of Kashmir. So could you talk us through that entanglement?
The first thing I want to say is that the world tends to talk about Kashmir always in terms of India and Pakistan. And this doesn't do the Kashmiri people any favors. For the Kashmiri people, the issue at stake is Kashmir. It is not India. It is not Pakistan. Of course, they are yoked to India currently. And so India is the problem that they face down. But I think that when we, as the world at large, talk about Kashmir largely or purely in terms of India v. Pakistan, in a curious way, we're helping India and Pakistan. The point about Kashmir is that it is a question of self-determination for the people of Kashmir. And neither the ruling elites of Pakistan nor the ruling elites of India have the welfare of Kashmiris at the core of their policies. Kashmir has been a very painful football for the leadership of the two countries. It's just one more football in a standoff that suits the elites of both countries. So let me come then to Kashmir. Now, last year, on 5th August 2019, the Indian government unilaterally breached the fundamental conditions of the instrument of accession by which, after colonialism, the former princely state of Jammu and Kashmir agreed to become part of India. The instrument of accession basically enshrined the fact that the accession was not entirely kosher, that there were issues to be resolved. And so the instrument of accession basically gave the state of Kashmir a special status within India, which acknowledged that this was not part of the Union of India in quite the same way. What the Modi government did in August 2019 was to strip the state of Jammu and Kashmir of statehood and special status. The special status gave it a right to have its own constitution and its own flag. It basically dissolved the legal entity of the state and annexed the state to the Union of India, declared it a union territory, right? So essentially, it was a form of unilateral annexation. Because amongst other things, any such move would have had to have been agreed by democratic discussion, debate, and a vote. And these things didn't really happen. So in fact, there is now a question to be asked about whether India's action in abrogating Article 370 was legal. And I believe, as do others, that the instrument of accession was a legal document and that India has violated, as things currently stand, the instrument of accession. And therefore, what has happened in Kashmir raises very, very strong constitutional and legal questions. But the other point is this, that in preparing for the move, India flew in more than 50,000 troops to supplement the thousands who were already there. So tourists and pilgrims were taken out of the Kashmir Valley, the internet was cut, phones were dead, schools and markets were shut down, 4,000 people arrested, Kashmiri politicians, including politicians who were loyal to India, were put under house arrest. And the Jammu and Kashmir Reorganization Bill was passed the very next day in India's parliament with two or three representatives from Kashmir. So what has happened is legally questionable, but what is just as worrying is the fact that the state of Kashmir has been under lockdown since the 5th of August. So we are going on what now 9 months of lockdown. Some internet access has been restored, but not much. And only last week, a Kashmiri photojournalist, a woman, was detained under anti-terror legislation. It's very difficult to get word from the valley about what is going on. So we have a situation where there has already been a terrifying lockdown in the state, which is already the world's most militarized region. Kashmiris face intense repression on a day-to-day basis. And the world has basically looked on and shrugged. And this, to me, is extremely worrying. You know, internet access is enshrined as a fundamental right for the people of India. And if indeed Kashmiris are Indians, as the Indian state claims, then what is the basis on which they're being deprived of their fundamental rights? There are very serious questions to be asked, and these are not being taken up where they should be taken up. And the world has essentially turned its back on Kashmir.
I mean, I suppose the question with India and Pakistan is this the biggest global nuclear threat that we don't really talk about? Because I feel like we don't really talk about it.
It is a threat. It is deeply worrying that you have constant standoff between two nuclearized powers. But I should say that what we should also be paying attention to is the fact that there are constant skirmishes on this border, and it is a militarized zone, and there are constant, in a sense, standoffs between two countries which may not press the nuclear button. They haven't pressed it, and they may not press it. And while the nuclearization is worrying, I would say that on a yearly, daily, monthly basis, I am significantly concerned also by the fact that it justifies the militarization of both states, and it justifies both states really, in a sense, using the language of militarized nationalism to keep their own populations under control. And so I think that although the world tends to view this quite narrowly in terms of nuclear standoff, it is, but I'm equally worried about the United States and Israel having weapon, nuclear in North Korea. But there is a state of constant militarization which allows both India and Pakistan, I think, to get away with a lot and to not actually focus on the well-being of their respective populations.
We'll have to do a podcast in the future with Mary Kaldor, actually, who works with Another Europe. But what you just described in terms of the role that war plays within India-Pakistan domestic politics is very similar to what she says about war as a social condition. So it's no longer a conflict in the conventional sense between 20th century nuclear armed powers engaged in this standoff, but actually becomes a way of disciplining domestic populations.
It is interesting because obviously authoritarians are divided in their responses. They either laugh it off, a la Bolsonaro, or they use it instrumentally to become even more authoritarian in the manner of Viktor Orban, with Trump, I suppose, kind of occupying those two positions intermittently. How would you say Modi is responding, and how are people responding to him?
This is a slightly difficult topic to talk about because I am not yet in a position to judge the numbers coming out of India. And if you look at it one way, so far the Indian response to the coronavirus has been a success story. The number of deaths are still very low. There is not, you know, community-wide waves of transmission. On the face of it, some of the moves taken by the government have worked, including kind of testing, contact tracing, lockdowns. But skepticism has been rightly expressed in sections of the critical media in India, which are very small sections, about the low figures and whether they are really credible. What we do know is that, like in many other places, India's health system is not equipped to deal with larger numbers, and that poor people are suffering under the lockdown, which was announced overnight and instantly, and put, as we know, thousands and thousands of migrant workers in India, workers who were living in states other than their own, it put them in a very difficult position.
Well, thousands of migrant workers and daily wage workers who have no jobs or shelter have crossed over to their hometowns, while many others are still waiting to do so. In fact, they are so desperate that if need be, they don't mind walking the entire way back home.
There has been an unfolding humanitarian catastrophe as far as migrant workers are concerned. And there are concerns that the public distribution system, as far as food and food supplies are concerned, isn't working as it should, that sufficient amounts of food and safeguards in terms of nutrition have not been released. So I would say that the jury is potentially out on how India has dealt with the coronavirus, but we do know that the story as far as the lockdown and how it has disproportionately affected poorer people without sufficient safeguards is worrying. And I think we're going to hear more about that in days to come.
From the perspective of India, the crisis actually looks quite different. The economic consequences of the lockdown seem to be socially more unjust than the disease itself.
So far, but as I said, I think we have yet to see what the full picture is. Modi invited senior editors and owners of the media last week, or maybe it was 10 days ago, to come and see him. And at this meeting, he asked them not to provide negative stories, as he called it, about the situation with the coronavirus. And 18 out of those 20 editors, as I understood it, agreed.
Wow.
So we do not actually know the full story of what is going on with the coronavirus. I'm being careful in what I say here because I do not have all the facts. I would be very, very surprised if the humanitarian catastrophe that unfolded with migrant workers didn't continue, and if there weren't stories that will eventually come out about how the lockdown has, you know, disproportionately affected the poor because it wasn't planned well, it wasn't led up to, it wasn't phased in the way that it should have been. But as far as the Indian economy is concerned, the interesting thing, of course, is the Indian economy has been tanking for the last few years. And this is something that I think if I were the BJP, I would be very worried about indeed. But so far, ethno-nationalism and majoritarianism seems to be doing the trick as far as the Indian middle classes are concerned. They have, you know, solidly thrown their weight behind the lockdown. And there is no evidence yet that the government is in trouble. But that picture may well change once we have the full economic picture, once the lockdown is lifted and you know, we start to figure out what is going to happen.
And just one final thing on Modi. How does he orient himself towards science and expertise? Is he a joyous ignoramus like Trump, or is he a bit more cautious?
He's a bit more cautious. That's not hard. I think that he would probably not be caught saying something as silly as drink bleach to see if that will deal with the coronavirus. But he has said things in the past around, for instance, radars and the advice that he has given to the army, which the army took, and therefore they were successful on launching a strike on Pakistan, which turned out to be ludicrous in scientific terms. But he's certainly more cautious. Modi is very good at maintaining silence around things that might land him in trouble. He has not really been known to comment on, for instance, the lynchings of Dalits or Muslims that have taken place in India, although he's a copious user of Twitter. He is more careful. It should be said, though, that the Hindu right as a whole outstrips Trump when it comes to ludicrous claims about science. So we have heard bizarre claims about ancient India and ancient Hindu texts having pioneered rocket science and plastic surgery thousands of years before Christ, that kind of thing. So Modi writes a kind of double-edged sword. On the one hand, there is this kind of ludicrous claims about ancient India and Hinduism. And on the other hand, of course, India as a major technocratic and scientific power. But what we do know is that the state of science in India, science and technology, is extremely poor. It's underfunded, and there is no real culture of research and development in India as far as science goes.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. Coronavirus Lockdown is a new series of podcasts from the Another Europe team with support from Global Justice Now. If you want to know how the discussion ends, you can access additional material by joining the Another Europe is Possible campaign. Members of Another Europe help keep the show on the road even in these difficult times. To join, go to anothereurope.org/join. In this week's Extra Time, we ask Priya to draw out some of the lessons of India for the fight against authoritarianism globally. We'll be back very soon. See you then. Those scenes of the migrant workers stranded in the cities, I mean, they were incredible, really, because it was almost like the government had not considered that this would be an issue to leave 139 million workers stranded with no way to get home to the countryside, and then watching people walking, hundreds of kilometres to get home. I mean, quite extraordinary. So apologies if this is a stupid question, but do some of them not vote BJP? I mean, to have that kind of self-manufactured crisis, would that not affect Modi's support electorally?
One thing to say about Modi's, or rather the BJP's current support base, the current support base is heavily middle class. And these are the people who have been targeted in electoral campaigns, and these are the people who have been targeted in positive stories about the lockdown. So, people coming out onto their balconies and clapping. Now, we have versions of this in England and in the USA, but in India, it was more or less a governmental edict, and people came out in a sense to show support for the government rather than for medical workers per se. Whether it'll affect Modi remains to be seen. One thing that the current government has been very good at doing is stoking divide and rule and channeling the, let us say, the resentment and the anger at injustice away from the people who are doing the oppression towards Muslims. So, for instance, blaming Muslims for the coronavirus is a thing, and it is a thing that is substantially more widespread than it is in, let us say, in Britain, where similar attempts have been made by the far right. So yes, you would think, and who knows, maybe there will be an electoral payoff in terms of the votes of people who have been left high and dry by the crisis. But that is not really how the BJP has worked electorally. It has targeted a prosperous middle class. And as far as the disenfranchised are concerned, it has worked with a divide and rule. So, for instance, the Dalit vote, or the so-called backward castes vote, which you would normally imagine would be a vote against the Hindu rights project, has been very successfully polarized and turned in against itself. So yes, you would imagine that there would be payoff, but equally, you would imagine that there will be plenty of divide and rule and stoking of tensions to come, which turns the heat away from the government onto the bodies of the other.
It's been an absolute education, I have to say. I'm so ashamed by how little I knew of this. I think because we tend to read in such broad brushstrokes anywhere, you know, that isn't either the UK or a neighbouring country. Very large changes can happen like this without that becoming part of the understood discourse.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the most distressing thing, I think, for me, is to see how terrible things are in Britain and America, but to also say you are nowhere near as bad as things are over there. And,
yeah,
and to have access to see what's happening there has been incredibly painful.
So what lessons would you draw from the rise of authoritarianism in India for fighting it globally? And are there any positives that we can tell from this really quite difficult story of rising authoritarianism and racism?
I think positives is a hard ask at this point, but I will say that the resistance to the Citizenship Amendment Act, I went to India in December 2019, I attended protests in different cities, and that was enormously heartening because on the one hand, we had a supine media. I mean, any journalist who tries to break away from the mainstream narrative is harassed. I had a piece in The Guardian last week about the harassment of investigative journalists and academics in India. So to see people coming out in actually quite large numbers, particularly young people, to say, this is not our vision of India. We reject the Citizenship Amendment Act. We stand shoulder to shoulder with Indian Muslims and with Indian Dalits. That was heartening. And in fact, until the coronavirus did its thing, those protests were still underway. And we know that in Britain and in the US and in Europe, young people are pushing back against the rising tide of, you know, retrograde right-wing authoritarianism and xenophobia. And my hope is that we can bolster, assist, and foster these nascent resistance movements, and that all is not lost yet. And that if we can remember that the only thing that will work at this stage is resistance, and somehow try to find a way to make coalitions across national borders, across regions, I still think that all is not lost. And that is the most positive thing I can say at this point.
Yeah, I think that's quite positive.
That is quite positive, absolutely. And that's what we're all about on this show. So thank you so much for coming on and talking to us again. It's been absolutely brilliant. It will also be one of the easiest edits ever because it's all just totally flawless in content and presentation. So double thank you.